This is Classic Conversations with Professor James Hartwell and student Olivia Robinson. Together, they explore the world's greatest literary works, one classic at a time.
Hello and welcome, listeners. I'm Professor James Hartwell from the Department of English Literature.
And I'm Olivia Robinson, third-year English major and your fellow guide through these literary journeys. Today, we're diving into one of my absolute favorites, Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice.
Pride and Prejudice. You know, Olivia, whenever I mention this novel in my survey courses, I see half the class light up with excitement and the other half try to suppress their groans.
Let me guess which half I fall into. But I realize that some of our listeners might not have read the book recently, or at all. Would you mind if I gave a quick summary before we dive deeper?
That's an excellent idea, Olivia. Please go ahead.
Pride and Prejudice was published in 1813 and centers around the Bennet family, particularly the second eldest daughter, Elizabeth. The Bennets have five unmarried daughters, Jane, Elizabeth, Mary, Kitty, and Lydia. And since their family estate is entailed to a male cousin, Mrs. Bennet is desperate to see her daughters married well.
And the story really gets going when two eligible bachelors move into the neighborhood, doesn't it?
Exactly. Mr. Bingley, who's friendly and well-mannered, rents Netherfield Park and brings along his friend, Mr. Darcy, who's wealthy but comes across as proud and disagreeable. At a local ball, Bingley immediately takes an interest in the eldest Bennet daughter, Jane, while Darcy famously snubs Elizabeth, calling her tolerable, but not handsome enough to tempt me.
Not exactly the best first impression.
Definitely not. Elizabeth overhears this remark and forms a strong prejudice against Darcy. Meanwhile, Jane and Bingley grow closer, but after Jane falls ill while visiting Bingley's estate, Elizabeth walks miles to care for her sister and ends up spending several days at Netherfield. During this time, Darcy finds himself increasingly drawn to Elizabeth, despite his initial judgment.
And then we meet the infamous Mr. Collins, correct?
Yes, Mr. Collins is the Bennet's cousin who will inherit their estate. He's a pompous clergyman who comes to visit with the intention of marrying one of the Bennet daughters. After being refused by Elizabeth, he quickly proposes to her friend Charlotte Lucas, who accepts for practical reasons.
Don't forget about the charming officer, Mr. Wickham.
How could I? Wickham tells Elizabeth a tale of being mistreated by Darcy, which reinforces her negative opinion. But the real turning point comes when Darcy unexpectedly proposes to Elizabeth, declaring his love while simultaneously insulting her family. She rejects him harshly, citing his role in separating Jane and Bingley and his supposed mistreatment of Wickham.
And this leads to Darcy's famous letter.
Yes, Darcy writes Elizabeth a letter explaining his side of the story, that he believed Jane didn't truly love Bingley, and revealing that Wickham had actually tried to elope with Darcy's young sister for her fortune. This forces Elizabeth to reconsider her judgments.
And just when Elizabeth's feelings toward Darcy begin to change,
disaster strikes. Her youngest sister, Lydia, runs away with Wickham, threatening the family's reputation. Elizabeth learns later that Darcy secretly intervened, paying Wickham to marry Lydia and save the family from disgrace. Bingley returns and proposes to Jane, and when Darcy visits, he and Elizabeth finally acknowledge their feelings for each other, overcoming both his pride and her prejudice.
That's an excellent summary, Olivia. The novel ends with both couples engaged, promising happiness based on mutual respect and understanding, rather than just social advantage.
Now that our listeners have the story in mind, I'm curious. How did a novel written over 200 years ago become such a cultural phenomenon? I mean, there are zombie adaptations, Bollywood versions, YouTube series.
That's an excellent question. Jane Austen published Pride and Prejudice in 1813, but it feels remarkably modern in many ways. At its heart, it's a story about misconceptions and personal growth. And let's be honest, who hasn't misjudged someone based on a first impression?
Exactly. Elizabeth Bennet is so relatable. She's intelligent, witty, but also flawed. She judges Darcy harshly based on one interaction at a ball.
And that's what makes her such an enduring character. Elizabeth isn't perfect. She's prejudiced, as the title suggests. But what sets her apart from many literary heroines of that era is her self-awareness and capacity for growth.
I've always wondered about the historical context, though. The whole marriage plot feels so foreign to modern readers. Were women really that obsessed with finding husbands?
That's a critical question, Olivia. We have to remember that in Regency England, marriage wasn't just about romance. It was about economic survival for women. When Mrs. Bennet frantically tries to marry off her daughters, she's not being merely annoying or frivolous. She's genuinely concerned about their future security.
Right. Because of the entailment on their estate, Longbourn would go to Mr. Collins, not to any of the Bennet daughters.
Precisely. Women couldn't inherit property in most cases, couldn't work in professions, and had few options for supporting themselves respectably. Jane Austen herself never married and faced financial insecurity throughout her life, despite being one of the greatest writers in the English language.
So when Elizabeth rejects Mr. Collins's proposal, even though it would secure her future, that's actually a pretty radical act.
Absolutely. And that's why I think Austen was quite subversive for her time. She created heroines who valued personal happiness and intellectual compatibility over mere security. Elizabeth refuses not one, but two marriage proposals. Quite scandalous.
I never thought of Jane Austen as scandalous. But speaking of scandals, can we talk about Lydia running off with Wickham? That subplot always feels so dramatic.
Oh, it's meant to be shocking. Today, eloping might seem romantic, but in Austen's time, it was catastrophic for a family's reputation. Lydia's actions threatened not just her own standing, but the marriage prospects of all her sisters.
That's what makes Darcy's intervention so significant, right? He saves not just Lydia, but the whole family's reputation.
Excellent observation, Olivia. Darcy's action demonstrates his growth as well. Early in the novel, he's concerned with status and propriety. Remember how he separated Bingley from Jane because of the Bennet family's inferiority? By the end, he's willing to associate himself with Wickham, a man he despises, to save the woman he loves and her family.
I've always been curious. Why do you think Pride and Prejudice has such staying power compared to other novels of that era? Is it just the love story?
That's a complex question. The romance is certainly part of it. Darcy and Elizabeth have become archetypes for the enemies to lovers trope. But I think what really resonates is Austen's razor-sharp social commentary and her psychological insight. She understood human nature, our vanities, our blindnesses, our capacity for growth.
And her writing is just so witty. That famous first line, "It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife."
The irony in that line sets the tone for the entire novel. Austen is poking fun at society's mercenary approach to marriage while simultaneously acknowledging its reality.
I've always wondered about Austen's own views on marriage. Do you think Elizabeth and Darcy represent her ideal?
There's certainly evidence for that interpretation. Austen herself turned down a proposal that would have provided financial security, but not, presumably, love or compatibility. Her letters suggest she valued genuine affection in marriage. But she was also clear-eyed about the economic realities women faced.
That reminds me of Charlotte Lucas accepting Mr. Collins. That subplot always makes me a little sad.
Many readers share that feeling, but Austen doesn't condemn Charlotte. She presents her choice as rational given her circumstances. Charlotte is 27, considered nearly unmarriageable in that society, with little fortune. Austen shows us Charlotte making a calculated decision and finding what contentment she can within the constraints of her society.
Oh! I almost forgot to ask about something that's always confused me a bit. What exactly was Darcy's position in society? He's not titled, right?
Good question. Darcy occupies an interesting position in the strict class hierarchy of Regency England. He's not aristocracy, he doesn't have a title, but he's a member of the landed gentry with substantial wealth and an ancient family name. His annual income of £10,000 would be roughly equivalent to several million dollars today.
Wow. No wonder Mrs. Bennet gets so excited when she hears about Elizabeth's engagement.
Indeed. And that brings us to another aspect of Austen's genius, her careful attention to the economic realities of her characters. She's very specific about incomes and estates in a way that might seem mundane, but actually reveals much about social standing.
I've noticed that her characters rarely talk explicitly about money, but it's always there beneath the surface.
Precisely. It's considered vulgar to discuss money directly, but everyone is acutely aware of it. That tension between social propriety and economic reality creates much of the novel's drama.
It's like today when people avoid talking about salary, but everyone's checking Glassdoor.
An apt modern parallel. I think that's part of why Austen remains relevant. Human nature hasn't changed as much as our circumstances have.
Before we wrap up, I have one more burning question. Do you think Elizabeth truly changes Darcy, or does she just finally see who he really was all along?
That's the kind of interpretive question that keeps Austen scholars debating. I believe it's a bit of both. Elizabeth's criticism genuinely causes Darcy to examine his behavior and pride. But she also comes to recognize qualities in him, his loyalty, his generosity to his tenants and staff, that were always there but hidden by his reserve and her prejudice.
That's what makes their relationship feel so satisfying. They both grow and bring out the best in each other.
Exactly. And that message, that mutual respect and the ability to acknowledge one's mistakes are the foundation of a good relationship, remains as relevant today as it was in 1813.
Well, that's all we have time for in today's episode of Classic Conversations. I don't know about you, but I'm feeling inspired to reread Pride and Prejudice with fresh eyes.
Next time, we'll be discussing Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, a very different kind of novel, but equally revolutionary in its own way.
Until then, keep turning those classic pages.
And remember, in the words of Jane Austen, think only of the past as its remembrance gives you pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Classic Conversations. If you enjoyed today's journey, be sure to subscribe and join us next time for another dive into the classics.